Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us for tonight's discussion on the green shoots of the new economy. And welcome to if you're joining us online. My name is Abby Innes. I'm an Associate Professor of Political Economy here at the European Institute. And I think you will have read the biographies in a bit of detail, so I'm not going to go into those in depth. But I find it hard to imagine a better qualified panel for discussing tonight's question. And it being the opening week of the World Cup, we have a substitution. The wonderful Dr. Julie Culkins sends her really sincere apologies and is delayed in her travel, so she couldn't join us. But somewhat miraculously, Charmian Love has been able to join us instead. Absolutely.
Dr. Julie Culkins isn't here. Can I take on the doctor so that I can finally be Dr. Love? I've always wanted to be.
So we have Dr. Love at the end, which I think is entirely appropriate. And she was going to be a relaxed member of the audience. So I think it's very nice that she's come, been willing to come on stage. Charmian is a regenerative business expert of many years, co-founder of B-Lab, entrepreneur in residence at the Said Business School in Oxford, and among many other roles, Natura's Chief International Advocacy Officer. But tonight, because we've roped her in at the last minute, she's very much here in a personal capacity. Charmian's left is my great colleague here at LSE, Dr. Frederick Basso, who is an expert on economic and environmental psychology here in the Department of Psychological and Behavioural Science. To his left is Anuradha Chugh of B-Lab, an incredibly experienced CEO and MD of multiple highly successful green firms, including the Pukka Tea that you've probably all enjoyed at some point or another. And finally, to my right is Dr. Akshat Rathi, an organic chemist by background and now senior climate correspondent at Bloomberg and host of the absolutely fascinating climate solutions podcast, Zero. If you haven't tuned into it, I strongly recommend it. So what is our theme for this evening? So clearly, we are living in precarious times. So the free market neoliberal economics of the last 45 years has failed in most of the terms by which it was justified, and like its Soviet mirror image in its last stages, the pathologies that it produces in the real world are more obvious by now than any of the virtues it was supposed to have. And that raises a really vital question, which is, what do we want to do instead? If the real economy is not, in fact, a simple machine, if we do not, in fact, live in a computable world, nor a world of calculable risk, if we live instead in an evolving, complex and adaptive human system, and if Herman Daly was right, and the human economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of nature, then how are we going to reorganise ourselves to embrace those realities rather than to pretend that they don't exist? So how are we going to find pathways from a degenerative economy to a regenerative economy? So what we're planning to do this evening is to debate this for 45 minutes before we open it up to questions. And I'm going to take questions both from the floor and from online. If you're online, you can find the space to type your questions into the Q&A function. So, to get started, if you would kindly put your phones on silent, if you haven't already. I've asked the speakers to talk for 2 or 3 minutes on a first question, which is, why do we need to take the development of regenerative firms and finance seriously as a strategy? What are the proofs of principle that it's a credible way to go? Anuradha, would you like to begin? Sorry, I've landed on you, but you have so much experience. I think that's a good place to start.
So I come from the business world. So I've spent most of my adult life being an operator, managing companies and trying to get profit to work. At the same time, depending on which company you are, the agenda kind of moves. I've worked on brands like Dove, where very early on I learned that businesses and brands can have a voice and they can decide what to do with their voice. And I was very lucky in my earlier career to see that you can, as a business, you can be a force for good. I then went on to also work on firms which we would consider more in the area of really working towards balancing profit, the good that they do for people as well as the planet. Ben & Jerry's and lastly Pukka Herbs as well. And right now I'm deeply involved with businesses that are B Corps, and I don't know how many of you know of B Corps. But again, B Corps, no firm is perfect, but it's the direction and the journey in which they want to go. And B Corps want to go in the journey where they are able to balance profit, people and planet. And it's that which makes me a strong advocate, having first-hand experience with business as a force for good, that makes me an advocate for the fact that this is the future that's already there. There are already 10,000 firms in 160 industries around, not just one industry, but 160 different industries, employing more than 1 million people, that are already working in a way in which we want every firm to work, every business to work. That's why I'm hopeful, and that's why I'm an advocate that the future we want to see is already here.
Yes.
It's small. 10,000 is not the entire business. And I also have first-hand experience that the dominant system, the extractive system that you talked about, doesn't want these firms to succeed. So there is a consolidated effort to not level the playing field. Therefore, this is a green shoot, just like your title says, but it's not enough. And together we've got to find ways of really seeing how these green shoots aren't smothered, but they're actually allowed to thrive and become the norm. And I hope we'll go on to have that conversation.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Action.
Well, thanks for organizing this. Abby was on the podcast and in a way has been a way to think about the economy afresh. It's been very useful to follow Abby's work. My journey begins as a scientist. I studied engineering and then chemistry. I did a PhD in chemistry. And, you know, as any scientist would tell you, it is science and technology that fundamentally, at the bottom layer, really shape our future. And I deeply believe that. When I started writing stories as a hobby, that was just something I, you know, enjoyed doing as a student journalist, and decided maybe this is something I want to do full time, I realized you look around the world and you see many really good ideas that never, you know, basically good ideas that never make it and never shape the world and never change the world. And why is that? And that's because of really two forces, political forces and business or capital. And so to me, studying those forces became a much better driving force to understand the world we are living in. And climate change, in a way, is the wedge through which we can understand it, because it's sort of a forcing mechanism to make politics and business reckon with what is happening around in our world. To me, the side of regenerative businesses, as Anu talked about, they are small, but it is these examples, and you know, you said 10,000 now. That's grown from a few hundred not very long ago. It's those examples that then replicate and grow. While there are other forces like political and business forces, or you know, shareholders or big corporations that have a lot of incumbency that they want to protect, the examples of how regenerative firms can work is really something that can be replicated, just because we know where we've gone from 100 to 10,000 in the last 20 years or so. And looking at those examples is a really powerful way to start to think about this conversation, which is going to be complicated, which will not have one clear answer. But because these firms can show that it is possible to have profit and planet in mind, there is a way out.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Show me.
Gosh, where to go? I mean, there's so much that's already been shared. I really like the framing question, actually. And I think we can all agree that the system we are in right now is broken. I mean, I'm looking at the weather forecast for next year or next week. It's going to be like 31 degrees. We've already had 35 degrees Celsius weeks here in London in May. Like, we've got to figure out a way of fixing what is a seriously broken system. And this panel is not about what's broken. It's about the things that we're going to focus on, but I think we need to really recognize the significance of the moment and the opportunity that we have to fix something that is broken. But we have to be really careful what mindsets we're bringing into that approach to fixing the system. Einstein had this quote, I think it was from Einstein, that the definition of insanity is to keep on doing the same thing and expect a different response. And I really hold on to that tightly because I think we all need to be exploring and building courage and bravery to try different things out. So that's the first thing I'd say is like in the context of where we're at, we have to be looking for new innovative approaches to address this broken system. And then I want to build on this idea because I think we should be really clear. We're talking about regenerative economies and regenerative systems, and then we're talking about regenerative business. And I think we need to be clear of what is happening at an entity level and then what is part of the bigger system level and what is the role of the entity in connecting with the system. I'm going to go out on a limb and say something. Maybe my other fellow panelists will disagree, but I don't think there is a regenerative business right now. I think our systems are so dependent on extractive models that even people that say we're regenerative, I'm like highly suspicious because it makes me really wonder what is the definition of regeneration you're using? Because the definition for regeneration I use is that you've got to be going beyond the status quo. You've got to be actively creating positive impact. Yes, for your business, if you're a business, you have to have your financial capital, but you also need to be creating positive impact. In other words, internalizing the externalities related to the social capital, the human capital, and the natural capital. So if you're a business that's able to do that, then like that's interesting. And then the question is, how much can you scale that up? That's why I'm wearing my T-shirt. As you said, I'm like a substitute. So I was at an earlier event all day today with a group of accountants that are talking about how do we value these capitals and how do we roll this out. That's why I'm wearing my Accountants Will Save the World T-shirt. For record, I think lawyers will save the world. Professors will save the world. Lecturers, students, like everyone's going to have to roll as well to save the world. But I was really feeling the love for accountants today because this idea of how do we internalize these externalities, I think, is a really fundamental part of how we go on this entity level journey to become a regenerative business. I have the great pleasure of wearing many hats. And so one of them is this role at Natura, which I took on a couple of years ago. Natura is the first publicly traded company to be a B Corp. And slight correction, I was not the co-founder of B Lab. It was B Lab UK. So I cannot take credit for the whole thing. But Anu and I have worked together in the UK in building that movement. So Natura itself, again, first publicly traded company, it's Brazilian based. And I make that point because I think there's a really important global conversation we have to have about what we can learn from the organizations and the businesses that are on this journey coming from the perspective of the global south. And I can share a little bit more about what Natura is doing in the work that we're doing on our journey to become regenerative. But here, closer to home, I also have a role at House of Hackney, which is another UK-based B Corp, where last year I was appointed to be their legal representative for Mother Nature and future generations. And that's because I think part of the regenerative journey we need to go on is also to think really deeply about governance. So governance, accounting, I'm sharing all the sexy stuff here, like all the really exciting topics of governance and accounting and really looking at ways in which if we are going to go meaningfully on this journey and not in a like regeneration washing way, what does that mean? That's probably more than my 3 minutes, but I am happy later on to talk a little bit more about what that journey to regeneration looks like for both a big Brazilian publicly traded company as well as a SME operating here in the UK.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Frederick.
Thank you. Thank you for organizing this event. It's brilliant, and I'm very happy to be here and to listen to what you say also because it resonates with a lot of topics that I actually research with my colleagues. I am in the Department of Psychological and Behavioral Science. I identify more as a social scientist, but we engage with topics about economic life and the business. And I have been, since you were talking about your journey, every one of you, I started my journey as a student in economics, law, and management. So disciplines that are meant to maintain and reproduce the system, and they do it very well. Without a purpose, which is to actually explain to the students how you can change the world. So it turns out that you can live 4 years or 5 years of studies in economics, management, and law, and actually have no idea about what it will be to have the skills to run a non-profit organization, for instance, or to have a cooperative system, or to develop some form of economic democracy in your organization. And it might sound like, oh, well, actually, this is not that important, but it is, because What my colleagues here were mentioning is that the system is broken. So we teach people to reproduce something that is broken. We don't explain to them how they can actually fix it. And there is an important point there, is that when you ask people, managers or students in business schools, but also managers like working in UK companies, which we did with a colleague of mine, Dario Krappen, and another colleague, Jenny Miles, who works in the non-profit sector, we actually found out that managers would love to learn more about alternative economic systems and alternative businesses. And they do feel that actually they are isolated. So many of them, the vast majority of them, would like to see another kind of business to be developed, but they tend to think that other people within their environments don't want to see that happening. This is what we call in psychology pluralistic ignorance. So to make it very clear, you have about 80% of the people who are willing to see something different, but they tend to think that actually it might be not the majority or a minority of people who are actually to see this happening. So they tend to silence themselves. And so they don't talk about that. And it doesn't come at the forefront of the conversations. Well, actually, there is a general agreement that we need to do things differently. As you can see, it's illustrated here. There is another point that is important here, is that when you ask business school students if they would like to learn about something that is post-capitalist or something that is alternative to capitalism, or I'm not going to mention socialism because it's going to scare people, but basically what you find out is that they want to learn about something alternative, they want to see something alternative, but they never came across. They are asking for it, but it's not provided. So let me conclude with one thing that is quite important that you really need to keep in mind if you leave this session, is that actually the research in management or in economics is not meant to address issues of sustainability or inequality. And it's very striking because they did meta-analysis of the literature, they did some calculations about papers and numbers of publications. If you look at journals that are very highly ranked in economics and management, actually it's a very tiny minority of them that publish on sustainability and inequalities. So to give you a figure, they looked at about the last 30 years of publications in economics in the top five journals. Economics is a discipline that is very hierarchical. You have five journals where you are supposed to publish, otherwise you don't exist, basically. And what they found out is that out of these 30 years, there were only 25 articles that were published about sustainability and inequalities. They did calculations in management. They found out that you have less than 1% of the articles that cover the topic of sustainability. 1% of them. So we are talking about the world that is falling apart, and we keep having research that is driven by questions that are about profitability or topics like growth. Okay. So I think here, when you have researchers who are meant to research this kind of stuff that is validated in the field, and you have students who demand for something else, I think we need to start listening to the students and the professionals also. Okay, I stop here. But you see the point, like there is a kind of tension and that we can address as academics, I believe.
Fantastic. I mean, I think from there, a good place to go is to elaborate a little more on challenges before we get to maybe some of the potential solutions to those challenges. So one of the things that I'm hearing in those challenges is that sense that because we've had this machine economics, there's a lot of organized forgetting in it. The things that don't conform to a lot of economic theory are either they're included in as externalities to be priced back into the system. But we think in these two-dimensional terms of allocative efficiency, and it's a very machine model of reasoning. So what I'd love you to elaborate on is how you experience that. So what you experience as the narrative limits, the kind of imaginative limits that you hit when you're talking to people about alternatives, but also the structural constraints, the financial constraints, just getting finance, the short-termism of finance, whatever strikes you in your experience as the things that you keep hitting against as barriers to expanding this way of thinking about things. What kind of things come up?
Do you want me to go?
I
like to go back on real lived experience, because then you're not talking from a theory point of view, but from what's actually happening. And I think it hit me sometime, not too long ago, 3 or 4 years ago, where, you know, you work with a lot of B Corps, so many challenges, small founder-led organizations that are really wanting to do the right thing, right? But our ownership structure is so monocultured. Our ownership structure is so much about just shareholder primacy and equity and the startup unicorn model being the only way forward, that that system is a big challenge. So we've got these beautiful businesses doing really well, getting a lot of, you know, love from consumers because they're different. They stand for something. They stand for values. But they've just not thought of their equity model or their ownership model early enough. And they've not thought of the diversity of different types of ownership models that there can be, like cooperatives, like employee-owned models, etc. Why? Why have they not thought of that? Because the dominant model is a shareholder primacy model. The dominant model is one which says, sell out, mm-hmm. when's your exit? VC, private equity-driven model. Or shareholder, when do you become, when do you get your IPO? IPO is the flavor of the week, right? So I'm not going to go down the IPO angle, but you know what I'm talking about, with IPOs being the thing, you know, when are you hitting your million? When are you funding, fundraising? And that's a big challenge. And that's a mindset challenge as well. Mm-hmm. So now I'm spending a lot of my time trying to understand alternative governance mm-hmm. and also talk to founders early on about alternative governance. And many of you might start startups. And, you know, again, if your mindset is about a unicorn, I would urge you to think about a zebra. Yes. Because there's something called a zebra movement. So please go and Google up zebra movement, because that is the opposite of a unicorn approach, which is become big, sell out. Zebra movement is about being sustainable, not in the green sense, but sustainable in the sense that I can continue and continue and continue for a while, doing the right thing for my employees, doing the right thing for the planet, doing the right thing for the people.
And possibly enjoying your life much more as a consequence of doing those things. Because part of what we're talking about is going from a sort of two-dimensional calculating economy to back to a moral economy, as if we ever escape a moral economy. We're always in a moral economy, really. So how do we make it conscious? What other challenges and barriers have you been? You've interviewed a lot of people. What do they find? What do they find frustrating?
I mean, I think there are different challenges in small companies growing and then big companies that exist that need to rethink and how do they work. So one of the examples that I write about is Unilever, which, you know, under, and, you know, you would know the story better than me, but which, you know, try to essentially not take away shareholder primacy, but try to modify it by, for example, making a small change where instead of reporting every quarter, reporting 1-6 months, so that you get more time to be able to deploy some of the ideas that you have that you think will do good for the shareholder, but also good for the brand and good for the planet, because it'll, you know, be something that people would want to choose because people can see the benefits. But that only lasted for a while. Why? Because at the end of the day, Unilever is owned by large shareholders. Now, what we did see briefly was these large shareholders realizing that the risks that the planet is facing is going to finally come to bite them. Mm-hmm. This in the environmental social governance basket. A lot of investors thought, okay, if we can price risk, if we can price the impacts that a warming planet is going to have on our portfolio of ownership, and then we can redirect our capital towards businesses that would reduce the risk to the planet and thus reduce the risk to our returns, then we can start to shift the system. Now, we never got ESG running its, at least for a few more years than the last 2 or 3 years. So we don't know if that model can actually deliver. Mm-hmm. But in principle, there is now better understanding of risk that can be modeled, that can start to, at least from a large shareholder perspective, because we're not talking about, you know, almost all of us, some of the people who have pensions over here, your pensions are being managed by somebody who owns trillions of dollars mm-hmm. or hundreds of billions of dollars. And those shareholders do not have the capacity to go and think of small business. They have to think about how to reshape the big business. And I see, you know, the attacks on ESG that have come from from other capital owners is one of the biggest challenges holding back changes.
That question of calculating risk is very difficult because risk models use statistics from the past. And it's in the nature of the ecological crisis that these are foundational risks. They're not systemic risks, they're foundational risks. So they have a very different quality. So we also have these challenges around methodologies, not just structures and ideas. Are there other challenges that you've encountered that you notice, Charmian?
Yeah, it's hard because I'm a glass half full. Like my glass overfloweth. And I actually challenge is how do we frame them as opportunities. Mm-hmm. But this point about risk is a really interesting one. So I actually sit on the TNFD, which is the Task Force for Nature-Related Financial Disclosures, which has been going through this process to create a way, a standard way, to be thinking about how we account for impact and dependencies when it comes to nature. And Natura is also one of the founding partners of the TISFD. And I want to flag that because we talked a lot about nature and climate. Mm-hmm. The TISFD is the Task Force for Inequality and Social Financial Disclosures. Watch this space. Actually, there's going to be a lot of more conversation about it with some of the frameworks that are coming out. But I only say that to say that yes, I think there's a recognition that these are risks and our current system hasn't been accounting for them with the right kind of thoughtfulness and consideration. And that's getting addressed with some of these organizations that actually have a lot of both businesses and investors that are, you know, adopting some of this methodology that's being developed. Now, I am a Canadian, so I'm always thinking of, like, where's the puck going next? That's the expression in Canada. Someone knows this expression. I heard someone laugh, so it's not just me. But in Canada, they say the hockey players, the really good hockey players, skate to where the puck is going, not to where the puck is. And so if we're skating to where the puck is going, I think we're also going to see, because one of the challenges is these things are broken into silos, climate, nature, people. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things we'll see is that there will be a greater level of integration of how these areas are actually, to use a B Corp world, interdependent with one another. And also the word integration becomes how do we actually then take some of the data, the reporting, the guidance that we are taking on board as companies, and how do we not just report on it, but use it for decision-making? So we integrate it into how our businesses take decision, whether that is capital allocation or, you know, what are the different projects we're developing? You know, to bring that back to my Accountants Will Save the World t-shirt, I mean, Natura is, and actually House of Hackney, both a big company and a small company, a Global South publicly traded company and a UK-based business, and both of them actually do have a version of this IPNL. So it's showing that it's possible, right? Natura has been doing it since 2021 with a combined social capital, natural capital, human capital, and financial capital. If you go on our investor relations website, you can see it. We're really transparent. We show exactly how much, putting a value to those different capitals, how our business is doing, and we are transparent. I can tell you right now there are areas that are really bright red, because we really have some problems with how we think about natural capital. So we see those, and we know that those are things that we are going to have to address if we want to be a regenerative business. And coming back to the question about the journey for us at Natura, being a regenerative business means that we are able to, you know, have this P&L, this integrated P&L, and that we are able to show we are creating positive impact for those four capitals. So social capital, human capital, natural capital, and financial capital, because we're a business. But really importantly, those capitals cannot offset each other. In other words, you can't just be really good in your social capital or your financial capital and bad at natural capital. You have to have positive impact being created across all four of them. So that's the Natura story. House of Hackney is doing it as well. They have a nature P&L. So it's just to say these things are happening. They're not perfect, far from it. But I think we're in a time right now where we cannot let perfection be the enemy of making progress, because we really need progress. Now, I've just realized I've done like the technical thing, and I've sort of talked about P&Ls and integration and lots of acronyms. And I remember, Anu, you gave me some really great advice when I was coming to you, because we've been on a journey together for many years. And I was talking about, oh, yes, all these different like buckets of things we need to do within a business to be regenerative. And you said, no, we got to pull this back, because actually it is the mindset. Yeah. And I would just really recognize that that's like for good and for bad. Like there is an inertia in our current mindset. So we have to see that, recognize it, and figure out how to change it. But if we can change our mindset, that is what opens up the imagination and the ways of thinking about new ways of doing things, which we need. One of the other lines, quotes actually from Nigel Topping, who was the high level champion for COP when it was here in the UK back in 2021. He said, we must be guided by the science and we will be moved by the poetry. And this is what I also connect to in the mindset. It's like, yes, we need to make sure the technical elements, the science, all of that is really important. That's really the thinking space. And if we're going to do the level of mindset shift and culture shift that I think this time really does call for, we also need to engage as humans. And poetry and art is a really powerful tool for us to feel the moment, feel the change. So I think we need the thinking and the feeling in order to do that. And that's one of the constraints I think we are experiencing in this world. We're not necessarily bringing our full head and hearts together for this work.
Well, evolutionary economists talk about the adjacent possible. So the idea that we do the next possible thing, but that's also shaped by what we imagine is possible. So the practical and the imaginary possible are always evolving, and that process never ends. But that's very permissive in a way. And it makes me want to ask, what are the most exciting projects that you've seen in your areas of work? What do you think are the most interesting experiments, the most interesting kinds of prototyping that you're seeing, the things that you feel are kind of breaking the mold? What comes to mind if I ask that question, Frederick?
So since you were speaking of poetry, it makes me think of metaphors. And when you use capital as a metaphor to understand nature and human beings, I think to some extent it could also commodify people and nature. And so there is a limit to it and to the ability to which with which we can imagine an alternative economic system. Perhaps by revolving around the concept of capital, we actually forget to think about people in some way. So if we want to put people at the center of the economy, perhaps we should actually challenge what we call shareholder capitalism, which was discussed so far. There are, and you speak about experiments, there are some interesting experiments that are done and interesting research that is emerging. It's a long-standing narrative that exists, which is what we call economic democracy and the cooperative system, where basically we're not talking about shareholder capitalisms, which basically if you have shares in a company, you have decision, okay? You have the power to make the decisions. But actually we consider that the people who work in the organization are the ones who should be able to make the decision. As such, today, a corporation, especially under shareholder capitalism, is a form of authoritarian regime. If you're not happy, you leave the organization. The power belongs to the people who own the organization, so the capitalists, right? And if we think of economic democracy, we could actually have people who make decisions, the workers who make decisions. How does it allow you to avoid the siloing that you mentioned, that we silo capital and people and so on? Well, it allows you to do it in a very clear way. Imagine, for instance, you work in an organization, and you work in this organization, and with the people you work with, actually, you can make decisions about the about the strategies that are taken by this organization, what are the prospects that you will do in terms of business development and so on. If you are working in this organization, it's very likely that you live next door, all right? And that there is your community, and there are your kids, and there is your family, and your loved ones, and so on. So you are going to care about what you do. You're going to care about what you do, because if you trash the environment that is around the corporation, actually, you are going to undermine your health. You're going to undermine the health of your family and your loved ones and so on. So you start rethinking about the kind of business that you want. And when I say that, I mean it because it means that, for instance, if we had economic democracy, so people are in charge of making the decisions, actually, we could have avoided situations like PFAS, for instance, which is eternal pollutants that we have, and the organization tested the products on animals. They were passing away 2 days later, and they didn't care. They kept producing these kind of products because basically you make a lot of return on investment on this, and it's profitable. But these have very long-standing consequences. So if you start thinking about your environment and your family, when you make an economic decision, it changes completely the prospect of what you're going to do. And just let me conclude about that in terms of experiments. Actually, you have organizations that do that. You have people who implement this kind of democratic decision-making within organizations. And it turns out that actually it increases people's well-being. People love being involved in decision-making. They love being part of what can be done, like together as a community, as a collectivity, and thinking about the business as something that is going to contribute to people around us and not necessarily something that is going to be about the bottom line and increasing profit. So I think it's the kind of experiment that we should think of, and that's challenging the displacement of imagination that is going on at the moment, meaning that we train people to improve a system that is a failure, right?
Yeah, and I think there are many experiments, there are many innovations, and the blueprints are already sitting there. The problem that we have is that there is no level playing field. Mm-hmm. And that's where it kind of does come back to policy. Mm-hmm. Now, I am a business person and I don't wait for policy. I will do what I think I can do within my means. But unfortunately, that if we want the whole system to come in aid of these green shoots, then we also need policy change at the same time. So we're talking about shareholder, right? There's a very simple, again, these 10,000 companies that are B Corps don't follow just a shareholder model. They follow a stakeholder model, right? There are many other examples of democratic different ownership structures that are already blueprinted. So something like the BBA, the Better Business Act, that we've been campaigning for the last 7 years, 7 years,
long time.
Is essentially that. It's saying the blueprint exists. We just need to be able to change one of the articles, which makes it such that it is right now. If you're a non-executive director, so you're a director of a company, you have to only follow the duties for the shareholder. You can't balance different stakeholders, right? Whereas a company like any of the B Corps, they manage the interests of all stakeholders. And what Better Business Act is asking for is that as a director of a company, you should be allowed to look after all stakeholders. That's a policy change. I don't want to get into the nitty-gritties of policy, but all I want to make the point is that we need policy change alongside. Otherwise, these experiments, these innovations, these niches will only remain as experiments and niches.
Yeah.
And that's not what we're here for.
One example that I'll try and sort of use as a way to thread the many narratives that we have, and that starts sort of in my sphere of technology development, is the Humble solar panel. Now, we've all seen them. It feels like a thing that's useful and it's, you know, growing all over the world. But I think we underappreciate how amazing a story it is in, you know, connecting all the dots that we are talking about, which is technology growth, policy changes, economic democracy, energy democracy. These are concepts that we could not fundamentally have with fossil fuel extraction, which is tied to a particular location, which has to be managed by a big, complicated machine that is managed by a big, complicated company. You know, the solar panel really got invented in 1954, and by the 70s, there was no reason why we could not have invented and developed solar panels much earlier. It was held back because of oil companies which had invested in solar, and then oil prices fell in the 1980s and they abandoned solar. It was then policy change that really brought solar back. And that policy change started late 90s, early 2000s in Germany, you know, massive amount of subsidy to create essentially an energy sovereignty. It was partly climate, but it really was Germany was not a country with a lot of fossil fuels beyond coal. And so it needed other sources of energy. It was energy diversification. So then you get subsidy-driven policy that creates the solar panel industry as we know. And then, of course, it's China that really scales it up. But what we are seeing today is an inversion of a business model. Solar panel makers make very little profit. People who deploy solar panels, who are everywhere around the world, they make more profits than the solar panel makers make it. That is not how the fossil fuel model works. Oil companies make most of the profits. Oil retailers, your gasoline station, your petrol station people, they're making tiny profits. So you're getting a place where, because the sun is free and it's available to everybody and the fuel is free, you're democratizing access to energy. You're democratizing now economics too. I've spoken to people now in Australia, in Germany, in the UK, in California, who have become electricity traders at home. They're nerds who've installed solar panels and batteries, who look at day-ahead prices that are available from their utility, program a little Raspberry Pi to charge your battery when the electricity price is cheap, and display and put that electricity back onto the grid when the price is high, and make tens and hundreds of dollars in one day. So it's a way of thinking about using technology and economic democracy to try and bring solutions to the people that are good.
What I love about that is it's almost biomimicry, right? It's the idea that each individual is somehow benefiting from these natural resources and putting them to work. And I think there are other lessons from biomimicry, which regenerative economics definitely leans into. So coalitions is another one. Would you like to say a bit about...
She's the queen of coalitions.
The coalition dynamics that we see in this sector in particular.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things. I mean, I actually wanted to riff on what you were talking about, biomimicry and what we can learn from nature. So I can address the coalitions piece as well. But, I mean, nature's been doing this for, like, over 3 billion years, right? And I think sometimes we forget that we actually are nature as humans. You know, we're in this system. We're all, like, interdependent with it. So I think it really behooves us to tune in and really look at what we can learn from how nature operates. And at House of Hackney, where I mentioned, I mean, one of the things I think is a really interesting innovation is actually putting Mother Nature and future generations on the board of a company, like as a rep. So that's my representation. So it to the point about agency and boards, like that's the role that I have, is in those board meetings, I have a vote on the decisions that the company is making, representing nature and future generations. So just to say that is that's a whole other panel we could do on what that means in practice. But part of that is also looking at how do we bring in the lessons from nature. One of the things House of Hackney did was early on in my role there, we actually looked at the operations of the business and we mapped them to living system principles in order for us to really see what were the ways in which our business it currently operated and could improve in terms of how it operates aligned with living system principles. And I'll make a sort of maybe elegant bridge to the collaboration piece, because obviously nature has a lot of interdependence and symbiosis. One of my words for the week is symbiocene, by the way, which is where we go next. The Anthropocene is now, but we go towards the symbiocene, which is where we as humans, we recognize that actually we are nature and we find ways of living with nature's rhythms and in harmony with nature. So that's something to look forward to. But part of that is, again, this idea of relationship connection, knowing that systems change is not something a single organization or entity can do, or single person. It is about joining forces and collaborating. So, Anu and I have spent a lot of time working kind of together around the B Corp movement. One of the initiatives that I'm excited about is we have a group of almost, I think, 70 now, beauty companies, so B Corp, certified B Corps that are all working in this one particular industry, and we have what we call the B Corp Beauty Coalition. And we come together and we exchange ideas, we do joint campaigns. We did a very big push at COP30 where we wrote a letter to the world leaders as a collective, as an industry. And I think that's an example of where we can build strength through collective action. You have to be a little bit careful with some of these coalitions. But again, taking a page from nature, we know we have to find ways to work together. But if doing things in your industry, I do need to put a disclaimer that antitrust law is serious and you have to make sure you're following the rules of competition law. You don't want to get in trouble with the lawyers for information that's sharing between organizations that would be competing in the market. So just for anyone who is interested in this coalition and collaboration space, yes, it works in nature, and we have to look at what the laws are in terms of how we do that in the right way in the business world.
I think like what you said is very interesting, because you used a different metaphor. You used the metaphor of Mother Nature. And that one is extremely meaningful. So first of all, it's a metaphor that is across every society, that you find the importance of Mother Nature. And it inspired new legal developments. And for you to realize what it means, it's quite consequential, because when you start thinking of Mother Nature, you basically, what we call in psychology, anthropomorphize the planet. Anthropomorphizing the planet can allow you to grant rights to nature. And it might look like something that is utopian, and generally people understand utopian as unrealistic, but actually it exists in many places in the world, and even in the UK they granted the rights of nature to a river. Why do I say that? Because actually capitalism relies on a very different metaphor, which is not the anthropomorphizing of nature, the anthropomorphization of nature, but the anthropomorphization of corporations. Legal personality, legal personhood is granted to corporations. So corporations are considered as people, and they have a will, and they can sign contracts, and they have some power, you know. But nature doesn't have power. So of course you have this imbalance that is going on, where corporations, to a large extent with limited liability, meaning that they don't really engage, the investors don't really engage that much their responsibility, can trash the planet without that much consequences. And by being, as an investor, behind the kind of mirror or like smoke of the limit of the cop of the legal personality. So if you grant rights to nature, you could have a shift that happens and that could rebalance a bit this case. So there is a lot of work going on this, and it could be a change that is radical. And you see, it's a very different metaphor than the capital.
And if I might just link that to the coalition point, because here again, many of the lawyers are working with open source. So when they're applying it in one place, like how's Faith in Nature was the first one to put nature on the board, they very quickly cooperated with other companies to see how that blueprint can now be applied. So again, linking back to the point about these innovations can spread through coalition, and that's really the power.
And should be taught in business schools.
And should be taught and should be given voice, should be given a platform. So the narrative change happens by giving voice to these.
Absolutely. So we actually call it a green print. I just feel like I want it, because we've used that word blueprint a couple of times, and at House of Hackney, we actually are saying we want to be building not this blueprint, which is sort of, again, metaphor. I'm so glad you're using the technical, sort of traditional. But like, it's a green print. It's like, let's use the ways of nature to build the plan for how we're going to go.
Talking of giving people a voice, I think it would be great to open this up to Q&A, also biomimicry, right? Collective intelligence is something that superorganisms use all the time, and I suspect we have a lot of it in this room. So I would very much like questions from the floor. If you could raise your hands, like this gentleman in the front. And if the microphone comes to you, actually, if we could go here and begin here, that would be wonderful. If you could say your name and affiliation, that would be wonderful.
Thank you so much for the great panel discussion. I'm Martina, currently working for a climate consultancy called South Pole, but also an LSE alum. So my question was about incentives. I'm really curious to hear from across the panel, what do you think would incentivize businesses and politicians to actually cultivate a regenerative economy as such? Where can we look for those incentives, potentially?
Fantastic. Great question. I'll take three in a group. So this gentleman in the yellow in front row, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you for allowing me. I am Ashish from India. I'm a regular visitor here. So, yeah. And I do believe that accountants are going to change the world, because I am myself an accountant. So I want a T-shirt for myself. Yeah. Now, coming back to question. Now, B Corp is a very model which is kind of a voluntary kind of a model, which is backed by a voluntary, organization. What I want to understand is why will it not be more useful if we have our governments having, you know, strong regulations and policy changes to back it up, so that all the stakeholders can take it on board? Thank you.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Just behind, thank you.
Hi, my name's Will. I work for a university project called London Social Ventures that supports purpose-driven businesses that are emerging from London universities. But my question is about the way in which, I suppose, the startup world seems obsessed, and maybe the whole world, with kind of AI at the moment. And I kind of wonder whether those businesses that are drawing so much attention, so much capital, can they also adopt alternative models, be innovative, be regenerative in the way that we have been describing today.
Fantastic. Let's take those. So, and I think they're very related. Yeah. You know, what incentives are needed to move the dial in both in the economy and in policy. And that, in turn, might lead to greater government action. What's your sense of that? And also, is AI a kind of rabbit hole, or is it a way forward? What do you think? Anybody?
I can take the AI question, because I think the answer is relatively simple. None of the major AI companies are going down that route. But that is not to say that it's not possible. So, you know, we talk about AI as this, like, one thing. It's not one thing, right? It's really these companies doing large language models that are, you know, towards a subscription model that will earn profits. There are ways in which you can apply it, and scientists are doing it all over the world now. You know, I did my PhD in chemistry 2008 to 2012. With the AI tools I would have had in my PhD, I would have, you know, probably done something else after finishing all my work in 1 year. Because it's really possible to do a lot of the work through computation now. That wasn't possible then. But you can think of using, and people are starting to, using AI models, not just large language models, but other types of machine learning models on nature, on really understanding the complexity in which the natural system is connected, on trying to understand the interaction between species. And that kind of work, if that becomes, you know, is absorbed by the types of B corporations that value nature, could have a way to get off the ground. But right now, nobody's doing it.
Can I actually just ask a clarifying question? Because we are just saying AI, and I'm usually the one who's using a lot of acronyms, but we have to also just remember AI in itself. It's artificial intelligence. And the reason why I bring that up, because I'm really glad you keep on bringing up words and metaphors, because that shapes our culture. Because sometimes when the AI question comes up, I'm like, just so I'm clear, are we talking about artificial intelligence or ancestral intelligence? Because that's another form of AI. And I'm kind of not going to answer your question directly, but other than just to bring that into the room to say that I think there are multiple forms of intelligence. We have like a real focus on the artificial one that is the hot story everywhere. But I think we need to have a bit of a discipline to also remember that there are many, many forms of intelligence, and it's not about one or the other. It's about how we as humans are going to become wise in understanding how do we bring these different forms of intelligence together, artificial, ancestral, and everything in between, in order to help us through this really quite critical existential moment we're in as a species. So I'm not directly answering your question, but anytime AI comes up, I've kind of made it a trigger to myself to make sure I use it as an opportunity for us to call out what AI is, which is artificial intelligence, when most people grapple it. And to think, yeah, and I'm not against AI. I just think we need to be clear that there's many forms of intelligences.
Fantastic. Anurag, do you want to pick up the incentives question?
Yeah, actually, it's very linked, the two questions, because I kept thinking about your question on incentives. And I had a very disappointing conversation yesterday with a colleague who doesn't work for an industry which many of us would boycott when we buy stocks, right? So tobacco. And in this case, they're not. None of the tobacco companies are voluntarily kind of going to standards that might be better. And the voluntary approach will only go that far. And his answer very much was, oh, but the others aren't doing it, so I'm not going to do it. Yeah. So I think you've kind of got the answer, that you're absolutely right. The incentive when we talk about large scale, when we talk about tobacco companies and all other companies, and not just about small challenger founder-led organizations, is essentially that it cannot be voluntary. You've got to find a way. Now, at this point of time, when there isn't government regulation, we are using incentives like the stick, calling it risk, resilience. So those are what we have right now. And I don't want to diss them, because they are incentives as well, right? We're all worrying about which of our warehouses are going to flood tomorrow. And therefore, we're taking some actions to protect the community that's around where we have our businesses. But these are all risk-resilient approaches, which is the stick approach rather than the carrot approach at this point of time.
I'd actually like to sort of embellish that question, because we have a wonderful question from Ektor Kapasi online, who asked about incentives. But at the end, they ask, how do we change the system so more empathetic and collaborative people are leading? And I think that's a really... It's interesting, because it implies that there aren't a lot of people at the top who are deeply frustrated by the frameworks in which they have to operate. But it is an interesting question about how do you encourage people to believe that...
Mindset question.
It's a mindset question. The idea that
that business is a place for creative people. Business is a place for people who love to collaborate, who love teamworking, that actually that entrepreneurialism and innovation are often rooted much more in teamwork than they are in, you know, methodological individualism. So what's your sense of how you broaden the sort of the attractiveness of business, if you like?
I think it's not a direct answer, but I think it's a question of narrative change, and it's a question of imagination, and language, what we're talking about. I was finishing Amitav Ghosh's book on the nutmeg curse, and that book essentially I found quite a difficult book to go through, but that book essentially talks about artists leading the way, creative people leading the way to really make the vision of what we want to see as our future. So it is narrative change led by artists, poets, and everyone. So the normal discourse within our responsibility should be exactly what Shah did, to stop someone saying AI and say the words artificial intelligence. Start changing the narrative.
I think the narrative correction also, you can sometimes actually look far deeper in history to find. So there's a book called Goliath's Curse by Luke Kemp that... looked at 5,000 years of history of collapse of civilizations, because our civilization is only the most recent one that's been built on collapse of past civilizations. And in the book, there is, you know, he sort of goes through this view, which whether I now name the person who's put that view out or not, we have all absorbed it at some level, is the Hobbesian view of without government, we are nasty, brutish, and short people, and that, you know, having government or having a leader is what allows humans to thrive. And he basically systematically shows that through history, if you look at civilizations that thrive and sustain and keep ecology in check do not always need a leader. The Harappan civilization is one of those civilizations. So the Indus Valley River north of India, close to Pakistan, is a civilization that lasted thousands of years, and so far nobody can say whether there was one leader that ran that civilization. It was a collective enterprise. And so there are alternative ways of thinking about how you can govern that also can work. But yeah, narrative, it starts with narrative correction.
Thank you.
So that's actually quite interesting, because we had the concept of empathy that came up. Now we have collective decision making. And of course, when we talk about empathy and collective decision making, we talk about people together and people are embodied. And of course, you have emotions and you have empathy for others. But when it comes to addressing the question of incentives, I think there are several techniques that exist. The first one is to think long term. If you look at the long term prospects and look at the reports published by insurance companies that look at the long term prospects, they're actually really scared about global warming, because they think that the world is going to reach what they call a tipping point of uninsurability, which means that we cannot actually cover the losses that are incurred because of global warming. Today, we estimate with macroeconomic models that it will cost six times more to address global warming, to not address global warming than actually address it. So the losses are massive. And when it comes to the responsibility of corporations, precisely, first of all, we should stop subsidizing fossil fuel companies. Many people think that they are just profitable like as such, but actually they are subsidized to a large extent. Perhaps you can check the figure, but the International Monetary Fund published a report and they show that it's $7 trillion a year that are basically subsidies given to fossil fuel companies. So $500 billion are actually the ones that are given directly, and the rest is because the society pays for the health cost that are associated with pollution. So if you, in economic terms, internalize these costs, actually they have strong incentives, the corporations, to take into account the fact that if they pollute, they might have a price to pay. So we should, instead of socializing the cost, society pays for health, we should have corporations that pay for this. And today, some organizations are taking corporations to court for them to pay the losses and the costs that are incurred by other people. And there are models in economics that allow you to trace back their responsibility. So it exists, it's possible.
Fantastic. Let me take two last questions. So Tommaso to the left, one of our great MSc students from this year.
Hi, everyone. I am Tommaso, and I am a student here at the European Institute, and I was a B student this semester. And so my question to you is, of course, like we understand the green transition as a collective action problem, possibly the collective action problem. But so we now live in a moment where we see industrial policy and environmental policy as a reflection of the rise of a developmental network state, so the co-participation of business and private. And so how come is it so difficult to really unleash the green transition and to start creating value for companies and for the people and to like serve public and private goods at the same time?
Thank you very much. And there was one more question over exactly on the edge there. Thank you.
Yeah, hi, my name is John Younger. I teach at the University of Montevideo in Uruguay. I'm a graduate here, but I spent most of my career in finance, worked for the Bank of England for a while. My question is, I think the conversation is a really interesting one about Mother Nature and nature in general, which for me is a combination of collaboration and competition. Within nature, I think there's brutal competition, which reflects our capitalist system, but there's also many beautiful symbiotic relationships. And so I find the conversation today a little bit one-sided, suggesting that nature as a model is something that we need to admire and subscribe to. To me it's a completely different conversation altogether. It's how we understand the competition, the brutal, destructive competition in nature, and yet also embrace the collaboration which creates the sustainability.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
I can take the unleashing green transition question. We are starting. So there's a report out yesterday from LSEG, which is the London Stock Exchange Group, that looked at the value, the revenue generated by companies that you would class as providing green solutions. So not all of their activities, but the portion of the activity that you would class as a climate solution, as a green solution. And the number is astonishing. It's $5.5 trillion in 2025. That's the revenue for the green transition, companies that are doing the green transition. Obviously, there's the investment figures. $2.3 trillion was invested last year in green transition versus $1.1 trillion for fossil fuel extraction. So the green transition is here and it's growing. We are starting to see the results. Pakistan between 2023 and 2025 went from 1% solar to 25% solar in their grid mix. 20% of all homes in Pakistan now have a rooftop solar system. And so you can start to see when you democratize the technology and make it affordable, you really can unleash in a competitive system. Why did Pakistan do this? Because liquefied natural gas became so expensive that the Europeans were buying after the Russia-Ukraine war that Pakistan couldn't afford it. It lives in a competitive world. It needs to have an economy that feeds its people. So what did it do? It went to the cheapest source that it could find, which was solar. So I think we are in that moment where actually having these conversations is very useful. And I'll end with one last thing, because over the next 18 months, we're going to experience what is what is called the super El Nino. And El Nino is a natural phenomenon. It raises temperatures globally, changes rainfall patterns in places. But this super El Nino is going to come on top of 1.4 degrees Celsius of climate change. And we will experience essentially what climate change on our current trajectory is going to look like in 2035 over the next 18 months. So if you are in this moment where you want to talk about climate change and you want to have a narrative change conversation, now is the moment. These impacts have started. India's monsoon, which starts in June, is 40% below normal levels. And India is the largest country by population and still is largely an agrarian economy. So we are unleashing forces that are going, that are hurting us, but we are also unleashing solutions. I think it's a very good moment to talk about radical change.
Just a brief comment about the question of nature. I don't think it's about like competition or cooperation in that case. I think it's more about questioning the values that underpin the system. The values that underpin the capitalist system are modernist values that create a dichotomy between society and nature. And we believe that we are owners and masters of nature. And actually, the question is to challenge this dichotomy between society and nature and trying to think of nature and society as things that are integrated and then learning from nature. And it's not necessarily embracing competition. It's actually trying to think of the solutions that we do in cooperation and in harmony with the current environment and the planet. So it's mostly about that. It's not an evolutionary narrative or in terms of competition, Malthusianism or things like that.
Anuradha, do you want to?
Oh, that was completely beautifully put. Nothing to add.
Thank you. Thank you very much. John?
I agree. Nothing to add.
I think that's a very good place to leave. So I'm really sorry that we have to wrap it up here. I think we could go on with this for hours. And I think part of what comes up is that we live in silos where we have these internal conversations. And this is a moment to break out of those silos, to talk across institutions, across companies, across finance, to mix it all up and to stop feeling like we have to stay on the single pathway in the narrow kind of tunnel vision that we have tended to have. So now is the time for a sort of enormous creativity and these conversations, I think. I want to thank you so much for coming, and I want to thank our speakers. So Akshat Rathi, Anuradha Chugh, Frederick Basso, and Charmian Love for coming in at the very last minute.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.